Hi, and welcome to the Man Down podcast, the podcast where we talk all things men's mental health, masculinity, vulnerability, and everything in between. From guest interviews with inspirational individuals sharing their own vulnerabilities, through to the breakdown, where we break down different types of mental health support so that you can make the most educated and best informed decision possible to get help for yourself. As Matt Haig says, man up is not a call to strength, it's a demand of weakness. And the time for man up is over. This is Man Down. I am incredibly proud to say that Man Down is brought to you in partnership with Better, a charity raising awareness around mental health and suicide prevention through a range of exciting events and initiatives. Please head over to www.better.org.uk, that's B-E-D-E-R, or find them on Instagram at better_UK. Hey everyone, welcome to episode 55 of the Man Down podcast, a very special bonus episode to close out season 3 and to close out 2021. I can't believe we are moving into December and moving towards the new year. Today's episode is with none other than Zach Abel. Zach is a brilliantly talented musician, someone I'm a personal fan of, and he's just released a fantastic new song called Less of a Man, which, as you'll hear in the episode, ties so closely to everything that's at the heart of this podcast. So I'm thrilled to have Zach on, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So I am joined today by Zach Abel. Zach, thanks for joining me, man. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. I was just saying to our lovely studio friend, Maz, that I've now recorded 50, I think this is episode 55 wow. since May last year. And this is the first one I've done in person.
Wow.
So I'm excited. We were just chatting before we came on air about the first and only time I've seen you perform live. Mm-hmm. Nothing against you.
No, it's
just
okay.
back in, God knows, 2017, 2018. Yeah. Neither of us can remember. Yeah. A show at the Roundhouse. And it's amazing to meet you. It's great to kind of have you here. We're going to dive into exactly what drove this conversation with the new track in a little bit. Mm-hmm. But first and foremost, for people who aren't familiar with you, who don't know who you are, who are you? What do you do?
Well, my name is Zach Abel. I am a singer-songwriter, and I describe my sound as kind of bit of soul, bit of R&B, bit of funk, bit of pop, whatever that means. And yeah, in front of me, guys, you can't see this, but I have lots of Tom Misch merch being shown to me. and I've done a track with Tom Misch called Beautiful Escape. And yeah, I'm in London, from London, speak English, I'm a male. Yeah.
That's it. That's the intro. But I guess where I wanted to start was, you know, we are however many months now into COVID times, mm-hmm. the dreaded COVID times. Mm. And I've spoken to a few musicians, artists, performers, and, you know, people in and out of the music industry. And it's obviously been a weird and difficult period. Mm-hmm. What's it been like for you? Like, what's the experience of the last 18 plus months been?
I mean, it's been up and down. I'd literally just signed a new record deal just before the pandemic hit. So I was very, very excited, very, very driven to be able to be working, like writing songs. I'd literally just come back from LA doing my first ever writing trip there, and it had gone really, really well. And I'm like, damn, I can't wait to travel and like meet new people with music. I just felt so like re-energized again. And then obviously the pandemic hit, and I ended up, you know, recording the vocals to my first single with this new record label in my own living room. and it was definitely a humbling experience. Obviously not being able to work with people in the studio, things moving to Zoom, you know, every interaction starting with, can you hear me? Yeah. I think I can hear. Yeah. I think there's a bit of a delay, like everything moving to that kind of structure. that was a bit annoying. But at the same time, it was cool because I was able to work with people in America, say, that I wouldn't have been able to work with it unless I went there, which can be quite, you know, costly and time consuming. So actually, I was able to work with, you know, someone on Zoom in Sweden and someone in LA. And that was quite freeing. And some really cool ideas came from that. A few tracks, which are actually going to be on my album, came from that kind of setup. So that was really interesting, just to kind of say to myself, this can be done like this. I didn't know it could be done like this, but we've kind of been forced into working this way. And that was quite inspiring. From a mental health point of view, the idea of COVID actually really scared me. I remember having a bit of a panic attack, like a couple of months into lockdown, you know, just thinking, is this feeling that I'm experiencing, is that COVID? Maybe I've already got it. And especially when we didn't know a lot about it, I got quite worried and it was quite difficult for me. And then when I had COVID, I was definitely a lot more worried, just because, you know, I had the thing which was the subject of a global pandemic. Mm-hmm. And I'm quite a warrior anyway. So it kind of added to that. I was totally cool.
Yeah.
And took me a while, but my smell is finally kind of returned after about 10 months or something like that.
Good. It's finally back.
Finally back. Yeah.
Good to hear. Good to hear.
Thanks.
And that was sort of, I guess, a nice interlude into my next question, which was, as an individual, as a male individual, mm-hmm. what has your, you know, inside and outside of COVID, what has your experience of mental health been just throughout your life? Like, what has been the ups, the downs, the round and rounds?
So I've had some experience with anxiety and depression. I think my first experience with that was when I was 14. I was playing table tennis for England at the time.
That is unreal.
Yeah.
So good.
yeah, I was ranked number one in the country for my age group, and all I wanted to do was table tennis. And I wasn't sure if I should leave my kind of good school, which I was in, where I had an 100% bursary to be there, and go to like a sports academy, or whether I should go to this school or that school, or stop table tennis, whatever it was. And I found the whole thing quite overwhelming. And looking back on it now, I was experiencing anxiety and probably depression, because I felt this kind of sense of like haziness about it. And that, that actually is how I got into songwriting. I wrote about it, wrote a song called Haze. And so I think, yeah, from the age of 14, kind of was introduced to anxiety and depression. And when I was about 21, I was experiencing it quite badly. And so I decided to go to therapy. And that was really, really helpful for me. I learned about mindfulness through that experience. And that's been a really, really useful tool to kind of combat those feelings of anxiety and depression. But, you know, I don't think it's something, I don't think anxiety and depression is something you just experience one time and then you kind of get over it and then you're sorted now. Mm-hmm. I think it's a perspective which can come back whenever, really, and it's something which you have to develop ways of dealing with and incorporating into your life and kind of not panicking when it happens. And yeah, everyone has their own individual relationship to it.
For sure. Yeah, no, I'm very much like, that is my take on it, for sure. I had similar experiences with anxiety from 15 to 25 on and off. And I think the reason that it lasted for such a prolonged period was because I didn't really know what was going on. I just thought I was sad or like worried.
Yeah.
I didn't have, you know, the way, the language to describe it. And I definitely didn't have the knowledge or the self-awareness to know what could help me or even to ask for help, right? So yeah, I think it's definitely a relatable experience, something that I'm sure a lot of people can relate to. And as well, I think the whole piece around it not being, I guess, this like have or have not, it's more a case of learning about yourself, learning what the experience looks like, learning the signs, maybe the warning signs of when you might be heading down a slippery slope towards feeling like that, and then being able to check yourself. So I guess it does come back to that self-awareness piece. And with, I suppose, music, you know, you mentioned mindfulness there. Is music quite a big part of, you know, you mentioned there writing the song Haze. Has it been quite a big part of helping you sort of understand yourself, get to know yourself, and almost release and work with your emotions, work with what's going on inside your mind?
Definitely, definitely. I think whenever you have like a strong emotion and you go into the studio, it's brilliant because you can talk about whatever you're feeling. It's a very kind of cathartic way of fully processing whatever that experience is, whether that's, you know, I feel really angry that this person said this thing to me. You can write a song about it, and you can spend 8 hours indulging that feeling and having people listen to you. I think that's quite a privileged position to come from. Like, imagine if, you know, you're not in like a musical situation and you rock up to work and you're like, hey, I know that we're supposed to do this work, but I just wondered if you could listen to my problems for about 8 hours and maybe really, you know, indulge me in that. It's that's very unlikely that will happen.
Yeah.
So I suppose I am in quite a privileged position in that whenever I go into the studio to write about something, I have an opportunity to truly like really feel every element of whatever it is I'm feeling and you know, take it apart and face it.
Yeah. I think it's amazing. I think I'm sure there'll be people out there thinking that they have colleagues who definitely try and come into the office and do that. People that just distract them constantly with their problems and their emotions. But I think it's such a powerful, I think it is. It's I'm jealous in a way, like to have that space to actually go and spend that time. It's cathartic, right? It's therapeutic to be able to actually go into it and process it, because that, for me, for a lot of guys and a lot of people more broadly, is a big part of the problem, is like this lack of ability to express and process emotions. And that's how we get ourselves into trouble, especially I think Brits are probably some of the worst for that in terms of like stiff upper lip and not working through that stuff. So I think, yeah, it's a really interesting take on it, and I think quite a powerful experience, I can imagine as well.
I think that being said though, there is a time for self-soothing and not having to rely on other people to figure out your problems. It's a balance. I think the majority of the attention right now needs to be spent on reaching out to people and letting other people help you if you can't figure stuff out for yourself. Are you allowed to swear on this?
Absolutely.
If you can't figure out shit for yourself, you know, there is really nothing wrong with reaching out to people and you know, leaning on others. That being said though, I was actually talking to a friend of mine about this just yesterday. We were talking about how, you know, it's sometimes tempting to think, I can just put all my problems on everyone else. But human psychology, if every single time you see someone, all they talk about is, this is my problem and this is my problem and it's difficult for me, over time, that's going to be quite draining for the other person. So it's a balance of, you know, not only having your interactions be, you know, I hope people can help me, because they also want to have good emotions and good vibes sent to them. So it is a balance. I would just say that.
Who are you speaking about?
No. I mean, myself, like I've had experiences like that where, you know, I'm constantly reaching out to other people to be like, this is my problem, that's my problem. And actually I've been not confident enough in my own mental capacity to make decisions for myself. But I think that's a big component of self-esteem, is to trust that your mind will be able to look at a problem and fix it, and you can trust yourself to do that. So just as a like counterpoint to that, I think that is also important.
It's been a really big part of my own experience with mental health, I think, is probably in the last few months, this acknowledgement, this realization of how important personal accountability and personal responsibility is.
Super important.
Because at the end of the day, as much as we are social creatures, we are like tribal beings, you have to, like, in a non-selfish way, you have to be able to look after yourself, because there may come a situation where there isn't anybody else to look after you, like heaven forbid. But you have to be able to take that accountability and that responsibility. And it's so empowering.
I think it's
great, as you said, to be able to lean on other people and have that support around you. But it's, I'd say, more important to be able to lean on yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's that, yeah, it is such a fine balance. And you should have both options, right? I think that's the goal, is to be able to support others, to have them support you, to co-regulate as well as like self-regulate.
100%.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that's spoken about enough within the mental health conversation?
It's a really good question. I think no is probably the simple answer. I think we're starting to see more of it, but I do think there's a lot of, just speak up, just reach out. And not only does that encourage sort of that emotional dumping behavior, but also you're relying on people who, when they're at their lowest point, to reach out. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I know from experience that that is probably the last possible thing that I want to do, is actually speak to anyone or ask for help or whatever it might be. And so I do think we put an awful lot of the onus on the struggling party to, you know, reach out and speak up. And I think that is difficult, but I also think we do ignore this element of personal accountability and responsibility. Yeah. And that, I guess, as well, comes with self-awareness, things like therapy, and actually being able to, I don't want to call it a battle, but it's what comes to mind, like win the battle with your own mind. Because I think for me, I suffered a lot with panic attacks, and the overwhelming feeling with panic attacks is this element of like being completely passive to your mind and like being taken over by your thoughts. And it's like, I'm not sure how I could take accountability in that moment. So it's like, it's this learning process. And I think that's why it's so important to keep having these conversations, to keep encouraging any kind of mental health support, like therapy and otherwise. But yeah, it's a really good point. I think there's definitely more that could be done to encourage that sort of healthy co-regulation, societal regulation, as well as like, you've got to take responsibility and accountability for your own stuff, your own shit.
Yeah, 100%. Because also it just builds trust within your own mind. You're like, okay, I know that if I'm in this situation, I've been in this situation before, you have that reference experience, and I was totally fine. And without kind of putting yourself in that situation and surviving it and like, you know, being able to thrive in that situation, you don't have that reference experience. Therefore, can you rationally trust yourself in that moment again?
Yeah. It's such a good point. It's actually something I've seen coming up quite a lot, both for myself, but just in general sort of conversation around trauma. Like, trauma is obviously this big buzzword at the moment that everyone's looking at. And I think it's important because it underpins, it's the unconscious, the subconscious level of why we act in certain situations. Some theory is around like the best way to change how you respond to a traumatic event or in the moment is about having a positive experience in that same moment. Like you said, like going into something that used to be terrifying and actually being fine.
Yeah.
And I'll give my own example here, because I don't always share that often on my podcast. It's normally me asking the questions. I like how you flipped it. most of my really bad episodes of mental health were in romantic relationships around anxiety, abandonment anxiety, really intense, like bad, ended most of my relationships. And I've been with my girlfriend now for 8 and a half months,
okay, cool.
I think. Sorry, Caitlin. Don't know when this is going out, so who knows? And to begin with, same patterns. Like I'd done a hell of a lot of my own work, thought I was in a really good spot. I was like, yeah, this is going to be it. Like, this is the one. And the same stuff started coming up, and it was really intense, almost ended the relationship. And I spoke to a friend of mine who struggles with similar issues the other day. And she was like, how have you got through it? Like, I was in that position where I couldn't see a way out. She was like, I don't see how I can get through this. And I was like, I was completely relate. And the only thing I could say was, patience from Caitlin's side to like trust me that it is getting better, but also going into situations, seeing something that used to give me a panic attack and it not giving me a panic attack. And it's just a build up and a build up of those things where I'm like, huh, this I'm not getting triggered to the same extent anymore. Yeah. Like, it's actually fine. And I think that's really difficult because we're very good at being like, well, that triggers me. Mm. It's giving me a panic attack. Let's not go there again.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just, if you want it, if you want to work through it, you kind of just have to, it's almost like exposure therapy. Like, yeah, you put yourself through it,
yeah,
to literally the point where it doesn't hurt so much. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely a fan of that. I suppose, I mean, you could tell me if this is a good analogy. I just thought of it about 2 minutes ago. I suppose it would be like going to see a physio and they're like, okay, yeah, this is the issue and you need to do these exercises. And they're massaging you at the time, which feels great. But yeah, they're like, you need to go home and you need to work on these things while I'm not here. And if you only, you know, if you don't do any of that and you only go for the massage or the physio, you're probably not going to see that good result. It's a bit of both, isn't it?
It's a very good analogy.
Thank you very much. I like it a lot. Just thought of it.
Yeah, and it's a trap I've fallen into. And I think, I don't want to speak for anybody else, but I imagine a lot of people fall into, both with the physio. I've done that 1,000 times, but I don't do the exercises. But with therapy, like, you go to therapy, you find out a bunch of stuff about yourself, where it all comes from. They tell you, next time you find yourself in this situation, why don't you try this? Nope, absolutely not. And that's why, you know, doing the work in inverted commas is very fashionable at the moment, but that's why it's called that, because you have to actually put the graft in to make the difference. So yeah, I think this I like that analogy a lot. I will be stealing that.
Thank you. Please do.
I'll credit you. It's fine.
5%.
Oh man, musicians. So I want to talk about how we ended up here. What can only be described as a shameless slide into the DMs from yours truly.
So, very happy.
I got sent your story where you had a little question box up on Instagram, for those of you who aren't Instagrammers, asking people who follow you to give examples of times when they'd been told to man up. Mm-hmm. And my friend sent it to me and was like, you should get Zach on the podcast. I was like, all right, cool. I'll drop him a message. So I spammed your question box, not with an example of a time when I've been told to man up, but just saying, hey, I've got a podcast called Man Down. Do you want to come on? And I was just like, oh, I'll just send that out, see if it's, probably never see it. And here we are.
Here we are.
Here we are. So the reason for that question is the new track.
Yes.
Which is called Less of a Man.
It is.
And there's a lyric, which I wish I could remember off the top of my head, but I'm going to dig it out from my phone instead because I don't trust my memory. But it's something along the lines of, I'm pretty sure I wrote it down. Yeah. There's too many man down to be told how they got a man on up. Mm-hmm. And I was like, he's written this song for this podcast. It's my new theme song. And the track, I'm going to let you tell people about it, but people can probably get the gist of it, right? It's about masculinity. It's about this notion of man up, what we see in society with masculinity and maybe some of the issues within that. So what, firstly, give us the background to the track itself, and then let's dive into where it came from and some of the themes within it.
Right. So yeah, wrote a song called Less of a Man, and it was inspired by, I suppose, me growing up never feeling like I was a real man, whatever that means. I had this kind of idea of what a real man should be based on having met men who would be a certain way, and I'm like, oh, I'm not like that at all. One of the biggest ways was that I've always been quite like, I've always had quite a lot of empathy, and I've always been a bit like adverse to violence, and I'm not very confrontational, so I suppose I'm quite agreeable, and yeah, like I felt as though I didn't quite fit in, and I remember once going into a writing session ages ago, and I was talking to a guy, and I was like, yeah, you know, I want to be a real man, and he was like, what is a real man? Like, and I'd never really thought about it, and that I'd kind of been thinking about that for like a couple of years, and I was like, okay, well, if I act like this, does that make me less of a man? If I act like this, does that make me less of a man? And the biggest thing is if I'm, you know, open about my emotions and reach out for help, does that make me less of a man? Because I feel like a big part of why there's so many male suicides is because a lot of men feel as though they can't be vulnerable and they have to always be the ones to, you know, make sure their shit's together and, you know, be the strong one, either in a relationship or in their own life or whatever it is. And I was like, I'd like to write about that because it's something which I've struggled with myself and I feel like is something which we need to be talking about.
For sure. I mean, that's a horrible cliche, but music to my ears.
See what you did there. Nice.
Sometimes I really hate myself, but it just comes out of my mouth. Yeah, you know, it's very much aligned with what we do here at Man Down Studios.
Man Down Corp.
Man Down Corp, Inc. Yeah. So no surprises there. And I think it's, you know, I'm very grateful, A, that you're here and we're having this conversation, but also that you've written the track, because I think you shared a screenshot of some YouTube comments the other day that were slightly less positive than my review of the track.
So much, man.
Which I think just highlights the issue, right? And I think there is so much to be said. I completely agree with you. You know, we've created this real man that is accepted in society as really, you know, macho, masculine, and it's killing us. Like, actually killing us in terms of the way in which we're not able to show up vulnerably and speak about emotions openly, and beyond that, not actually even for a lot of people, like, feel their emotions. I think I always come back to this fact that one of the traits that you'd find listed under that real man would be like emotionless, and that blows my mind, because as human beings we are emotional. Like, we all have emotions. Like, that's not a thing that you can't be. And so to actually be raised in a society where you are expected or encouraged to be that way is so harmful. So yeah, I think it's definitely a timely and important track, and the video is incredible as well. I love the video. Is it fun to make?
Oh, it was very, very fun. Yeah. Yeah. I flew out to Germany and just had a huge cast of, you know, dudes from kind of, yeah, all different backgrounds, and we were all kind of portraying things which were typically not masculine things. So I don't know, like flower arrangement or like ballet, and the whole thing was to point out that these things have been stereotypically feminine things, but if you really think about it, they should exist outside of the realm of masculinity and femininity. Like, why is it that we associate ballet with femininity? Surely anyone, any human being can do ballet, and yet we associate that with femininity. In the same way, any human being, like you were saying, can feel emotional. But why do we associate being open about your emotions with femininity? Obviously, that's not, it hasn't been useful, because men are suffering because of it. And we need to make the rules work for us. And right now, I feel like the rule should be, you should be able to be open about your emotions regardless of, you know, if you're a man or not.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. I think it's important as we move towards a more sort of non-binary society as
100%,
well. 100%, yeah. I went for dinner with a old friend of mine last night, and I've known him for probably close to 20 years. And I know his family well, know his older brother well. And I was like, oh, how's the family? And we were talking about his brother. He was like, yeah, he's non-binary, polyamorous, very open. And really interestingly, he actually said he's not non-binary because he has sort of different thoughts on what his sort of gender is, but he's non-binary because he rejects the idea of what a man is in society in terms of what he was raised to view, like we've talked about, as manly or like a real man, which I thought was really interesting. I think it's something we're going to see more and more, is like this, I guess you sort of got real man up here, or traditional real man up here, and, you know, whatever would be considered a real woman at the other end of the spectrum. And we're going to see a real, I think, flattening of that sort of spectrum to have everybody at different points along that spectrum, regardless of, you know, obviously there's biological sex, but then gender within that, which I think is fascinating. But I think it's going to, this is what I'm noticing as well with social media and mainstream media, is like, everybody's terrified of making mistakes. And yeah. I found myself there as I was talking about non-binary and like,
The spectrum. Don't say the wrong thing.
Don't say the wrong thing. Don't use the wrong pronoun. Don't do this. Yeah. And it's like, it's scary because of, you know, cancel culture and like the ability to not, we're not really allowed to get stuff wrong anymore. And I think that's really difficult when things are changing so much. I think we have to give people that opportunity to make mistakes as long as they're willing to learn. Mm-hmm. Do you find, this is a slight aside, but linked to that sort of, do you find that difficult yourself as someone who is, you know, more in the public eye than myself or like a guy on the street?
100%. I think I definitely think about what I'm posting online a lot more than I used to. And there's certain areas that I just won't talk about on social media, because especially things which are like serious issues where I'm not quite sure where I stand yet. I wouldn't use social media to try and come up with to try and learn and form an opinion. Mm-hmm. I would have those conversations with friends that I trust in private. Say if it's like a political thing or something, these aren't things which, you know, you can, you know, put your views out there and try and learn from it. They're things which will represent you forever, because they're serious things which mean a lot to people and impact people in very serious ways. Mm. So I understand it. But I suppose I only really talk about things that I feel very sure about and passionate about.
Yeah. I'm well informed on it.
I'm well informed. That's the other thing. Yeah. I see so many people, you know, posting like infographics about things as if they know so much about it. And I'm just never confident enough or, in my opinion, informed enough to actually do that and just partake in the copying and pasting of information.
Yeah.
I think social media, there is no room for nuance at all. And so with a lot of issues which are slightly more complicated, I won't post about it because firstly, I'm a curious person, and most of the time complex issues are nuanced. Mm-hmm. And so I want to learn about it first before I post anything. But secondly, I feel like social media is not the place for nuance. People want very quick, easy things where there's a very obvious enemy and they just want to like... pile on to that person 100%. Or organization, and they don't want to have to think, and that's not my problem, so I won't entertain that and get involved in that.
Yeah, I spend far too much time on this podcast bashing social media. that's my main bugbear, is to get to deliver impactful content, whatever the hell that means, and to get engagement, you know, that all-coveted engagement that everyone's striving for in the world of influencers. It's about massively overgeneralizing and being quite provocative in your generalization. Like, you have to pick that side. It's all black or white.
Yeah.
There's no room for gray. There's no room for nuance. And I think it's really dangerous because we already live in what is quite a divisive, polarized society.
100%.
And it's only making it worse, which is...
Look at America where you had... I didn't think I was going to be talking about politics, but like, look at America where you have two parties which are so different.
Yeah.
Like, they couldn't be more opposite in so many ways. And yet, it was so tight between who won. Yeah. It just goes to show how divided we are right now. And I think that's a big problem, actually.
It is. It's a very big problem. And yeah, maybe politics for another time.
For another time, hey.
Episode two. So to come back to, is actually something that on the topic of ballet. So I've been told by my mum that I played a lot of football, I played a lot of rugby. And apparently, I think I must have been 5 or 6. I asked if I could do ballet at school, like just wanted to do it. And to this day, like I can see throughout my life, I've always loved the concept of dance. Like I find it incredible. Like I love watching people dance. I'm not a great dancer. I've got some rhythm, bit of musician in me, but I'm not a dancer. But my dad, who I love, said no. It's like, no son of mine does ballet.
Wow.
and bearing in mind this was the 90s, I don't hold that against him anyway, because that's just society, right? Mm. That's not
probably his upbringing as well.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So please don't cancel my dad. he's a very nice man. And that stuck with me, because I just think it's, you know, we're obviously seeing progress and it's amazing mm-hmm. to see, but just thinking back on that example of ballet, I'm like, why wasn't I allowed to do it? Like, what was it about that? And it's super, super, super interesting. And what I wanted to ask was, what was your upbringing like? Like, what was life like for you as a boy? Like, what did that look like with family and sort of the things that you did and how you were raised into a man?
Okay. Well, firstly, I'll say ballet is one of the hardest things I've ever done. Mm. it's so painful.
Yeah.
And a very, very difficult but beautiful endeavor. Okay. Now, how was I raised as a boy? So it was just me and my mum. My dad lived in Israel my whole life. And so I'd see him maybe once or twice a year. I'd go and visit him. And he passed away when I was 12. And I'd say, like, I never really had a consistent male role model in my life, which I think I definitely missed growing up. Like, I'm very, very close with my mum, even to this day. Like I talk to her almost every day. But yeah, I think I definitely missed having a male role model around. My table tennis coach, actually. So I started playing table tennis when I was about 9. And there's a guy called Eli Barati, who actually I'm visiting after this. I'm going to go and like help out at his school. Amazing. Just to talk to some of the kids and play some of his students. Table tennis. Yeah, play some table tennis, basically. I say it as if I'm doing him a favor, but really I want to just play some table tennis.
Yeah, and win.
And win. Yeah. Yeah. but yeah, so from the age of like 9, 10-ish, Ellie was kind of my role model. He was, I think, 24 when I met him. And he was like he is quite a manly man. Mm. I think his dad was a manly man. They come from a generation of manly men. And so I kind of had a bit of exposure to that growing up. And I definitely felt not as manly as him mm-hmm. growing up, which is fine.
Yeah.
But worth mentioning.
Yeah.
What else should I talk about?
Do you think, so my parents got divorced when I was 15 mm. and I lived with my mum. Mm-hmm. I speak to my mum most days and nice. Lived with my mum and my sister. And I think that has massively informed my life as an adult in terms of empathy.
Right.
In terms of an ever evolving ability to feel my emotions and express them.
Me too. Yeah. Me too. Do you think that's because they're women?
Yeah, that was going to be my question.
Right. So flipping the script,
here
baby.
We go. We're going back again.
I asked the questions around here.
I do. I think, I guess it depends who the woman is. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom is very empathetic, mm-hmm. very emotionally aware, very understanding, very kind, but also very good at, she's not a people pleaser, whereas I am.
Right. Okay. I am as well.
Yeah. I could have guessed. Yeah. In a nice way. But yeah, I think that feminine energy, for mm-hmm. anyone who gets triggered by the word energy, you're welcome. That sort of feminine influence for me, I think really, and it's not so much, I think, a lack of like a male role model, because I spent a lot of time with my dad still, but that sort of depth of relationship that I had with my mum and now have with my sister, I think has really made a mark on my ability to, I guess, those traits that I think mainly around empathy. But yeah, do you feel the same in terms of how you've ended up?
Definitely. Yeah. My mum's a very empathetic person and it influenced me. I'm definitely more empathetic than most of my male friends. Mm-hmm. You said something interesting there. You said feminine energy.
Yeah.
And we all know what you mean by that.
Yeah.
Like you mean, I assume, energy that you normally have from women, which is like a certain number of traits, and there's mm-hmm. then masculine traits, right? And I've been thinking about this a lot, actually. I don't think that terming traits, and I'm not having a go at you, by the way, but it was something I've been thinking about, I don't think we should have masculine and feminine traits and call them like masculine and feminine, because naturally we associate masculine traits with men and feminine traits with women. And that can be quite harmful in a way, because, for example, one of my very, very close friends, she is a business owner, and some people have said to her over the years, like, you're quite masculine in this way and that way. And that doesn't feel very good to her, because they're talking about, she's a leader, and she's very like decisive and you know, knows what she wants. And people say, that's quite masculine of you. And I don't think that's very helpful, because then she's like, I'm acting in a way which isn't in accordance to my gender. Mm. This doesn't make me feel like I fit in. And that doesn't feel good. And I wonder, in the same way, you know, we're talking about those feminine, in quote, you can't see this, but I'm doing quotation marks, those feminine traits such as empathy and compassion, kindness, things like that. Why are they feminine traits? Mm. Like, why are they gendered traits at all? Surely they should just be useful traits or unuseful traits, or just traits.
Yeah,
you know, and certain traits will be, you know, useful in certain situations and not in others. And I really feel like, you know, you were talking about how your friend's relative identifies as non-binary, mm-hmm. and you're saying it's because they don't identify gender to traits, right?
Yeah.
Something and I fully get that.
Yeah.
And I think that is something which probably will change in the next, you know, few years or so, that we're gonna realize, you know what? Okay, just because historically men and women have acted in this way, or have been forced to act in this way, to so much so that we identify certain traits with those genders, that doesn't mean that's the way it should be forever. Mm.
It's one of my, I've moved too far away from the mic. It's one of my favorite topics. Mm. And this is going to, I'm really interested to see how this comes out of my mouth, because it's going to be thinking out loud. But the first point, and it's something I keep coming back to, is language, and like how simple language is, how complex language is, and how almost confusing and dangerous it can be when taken in different ways by different people.
Yeah.
And there are levels to this, because I got introduced to this concept of the five stages of masculinity or something. And I think the fifth stage, it's sort of what we're talking about, which is, they call it, I think, I'm sorry if this is wrong, but I think it's beyond masculinity, which is, and I actually spoke about this interestingly enough on the first ever episode of this podcast with a friend of mine called Sam Barton. And we talked about the fact that exactly what you said, it's not a masculine trait or a feminine trait. It's a good human trait. Mm-hmm. There are good traits, there are bad traits. Mm-hmm. And what are you? Who are you as an individual? Mm-hmm. And I think that is where we will get to. I think that's where we need to get to. I think the sort of intermediary point and the journey there is still very much bound by language, and that language of masculine and feminine. The way in which I think about it at the moment is that, and this is where I think biology comes into it, and like nature versus nurture, because there are biological differences between men and women, or males and females, and within that, I think as well, there's a spectrum of, there will be women with higher levels of testosterone, there will be men with lower levels of testosterone, and so there are maybe men who, or males, this is where it gets tricky, male individuals who are closer biologically to a high testosterone female. And so it's almost like we're human first and foremost. And then based on your biology, where do you sit on this spectrum of sex and gender? And then within that, what are the traits that you embody? And I think the way in which I've talked about it with a lot of people on this podcast and friends is, I think the best way to think about it at the moment is that as individuals, we all embody masculine and feminine energy within us. And that has just within, to come back to language, been conflated with male and female. So we tie, as we all do, masculine to men and feminine to women, which is why for your friend, for example, there's that little bit of niggle when someone says, oh, that's masculine, to for her to say, oh, you're calling me, not that she does this, but like there's that feeling that she's being called manly, when actually it's just people have put into camps these traits of, you know, with feminine, you know, when I said feminine energy, things like compassion, openness.
It's too late now, mate. You've said it. It's done. The damage is done. No, I'm kidding. Okay.
But yeah, I think we've just put these them into those buckets.
And yeah.
We all have the ability and opportunity to access all of them. And that's what, it's interesting because we've both talked about empathy and having quite high levels of empathy and patting ourselves on the back for that. But well done us. We're good people. But if someone were to say, oh, you guys are a bit feminine, it would be, A, it would be said in that tone and maybe a little bit
be seen as a negative thing.
Because it's not in line, as you said, with being with a man, with your sex. And it's just, I think, as I've probably just shown in that monologue, it's confusing. It's difficult. Yeah. It's a difficult place to navigate.
Yeah, but I think the thing you said about language is really interesting. So lots of languages where there are like masculine and feminine words, there's a movement which is trying to kind of eradicate gendered language because it does associate certain activities with, you know, either it being a man or woman doing those things, or like, the activities as male or female. And then we associate that in our brains with, ah, this is how a man or a woman should act. And I think it's a great idea to not have words be gendered, because at the end of the day, you want to have that kind of even playing field so that, you know, if someone has an interest in something, they want it ideally to be a gender-free thing so that, you know, they don't feel as though it's they're going against what is common for their gender. I think that's a good thing.
I totally agree. It feels, and I think this is maybe just a sign of the times, it feels quite far away, I think, to be like, and I think it's where we want to get to in the future, is this place where, as you know, as you've already said, for me, wanting to do ballet is just me wanting to do ballet. And I think all that will encourage is boys, girls, children into adults to, it just allows people to be more authentic and to actually do the things they want to do without that conditioned fear of
100%
backlash. And that is only going to make the world a better place.
Yeah. So life is hard enough. Like, it's, you want to be happy. And so I think just kind of making it as easy as possible to do the things that you're interested in doing, that's only a good thing, right?
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. That is how I if you're listening, I hope somebody's listening.
Me too.
whoever's listening, I want to hear other people's thoughts on this, because it is, you know, I want this to be as open as possible. And I, as we alluded to, like, I'm very happy to make mistakes. So if people disagree, I want to hear from you. Don't have a go at me. That's not what I'm interested in. I'll happily have a discussion with you. I'm not here to have an argument with anybody. I'm a people pleaser. I'd love to hear from people. Drop me a message and I might get back to you. Who knows?
Just don't say the wrong thing.
Be very careful.
Send in a message, but make sure.
Make sure you're thinking the right positive thoughts. So the final thing that I wanted to touch on is linked to that, thankfully, which is the music industry. So there's even something in my mind in which there's a little bit of femininity in the way that we've spoken about it and kind of the limiting way attached to being a performer, to being a singer, to being mm-hmm. an artist. I think mm-hmm. it is naturally more attached to that idea, which, as we've just talked about, is not what we want to see in the future. But for you, have you ever felt that in your sort of journey into the music industry? Do you feel, better question, what is the culture of sort of masculinity within the music industry?
To be honest, I've actually never really thought about that. Mm. I'd say there's kind of more masculinity or femininity in different genres.
Okay.
Like, for example, within hip hop, there's more of like a masculine energy. Mm-hmm. And we all know what we mean by that.
Yeah.
You know, that there's more kind of talk of violence and making money and hustling and things like that. Whereas in pop music, or maybe folk music, singer-songwritery stuff, you'd find more emotional things and admitting your own vulnerability, mm-hmm. which we, for some reason, associate more with femininity. And so, yeah, I'd say genres have more masculine or feminine, whatever that means, like inherent qualities. Within the actual industry, yeah, I think you have a wide range of, I wouldn't actually think of it as a gendered thing. Within a mental health point of view though, I think it's a very, very interesting place. One thing that's been really, really beneficial for me, and I would say this to anyone who's getting into the industry or is already in the industry, more so from an artist side, is it's really, really useful to think about what everyone is after in the music industry, what their goals are. So for example, if you're interested in signing a major record deal, for example, say you're an artist who's trying to get a record deal, it's really important to remember that a major record label, in fact, any record label, by nature of it being in the music business, it must make money. It's a business at the end of the day. So the primary goal of a record label is to make money. And so I feel like a lot of artists kind of get into a record deal and they're like, I just want to make the music I want to make. I know I've taken this big advance from this company, but really, I just want to do what I want to do. And there's often conflict because, you know, musicians get into the industry for reasons that aren't just about money. There's the inherent reward of making the music. It feels great. It's really cathartic. It's really useful. It's really beautiful. But none of those things are like 100% 100% relevant to a record label. If a record label puts out really, really beautiful music, if it doesn't make enough money, it can't pay anyone within the record label. It can't work like that.
Yeah.
So fully understanding what each facet of the music industry is and what their goals are is really, really important to know, so that, you know, you're aware of what your goals are and how they relate to other people mm-hmm. that you're going to be working with and meeting. Because that can be really important for mental health.
Yeah.
If you're like, I like this song because it means something to you, but the record label is like, okay, it's great that it means something to you, but if we put $100,000 budget down for a music video for this song, we're not going to see any returns because it's 12 minutes long
mm-hmm.
and it can't get on radio.
Yeah.
So obviously there are exceptions. Queen did accept, but like generally speaking, no one wants to lose their job. Like everyone's scared to lose their job. It's a great industry to work in and no one wants to lose that. So oftentimes most of the decisions that are made will be made from fear of losing their job. And is that what person X did? Mm-hmm. Like a lot of the time people are copying things that have previously worked and they're trying to make money and they need to make money in order to justify them keeping their own job. So it's good to bear that in mind sometimes, and be aware of, you know, what people need and what their goals are.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point, and I always love getting sort of the inside take on it. I wanted to work in the music industry for years and years and years.
And you still can if you want to.
That job offer.
Yeah.
We're the best assistant ever.
Yeah.
And I just heard I heard a lot of different things, and I think I probably, as happens with a lot of jobs or industries that you feel like you would be passionate about, there's a temptation to put it on a pedestal. And I was like, I love music so much that I would really want to work in that industry without thinking. And I think it's the same for artists as well. It's like without acknowledging the reality of it being a business and people having to make money and the competitive nature of something, because it is an exciting industry to be in. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is a really important thing, from a mental health perspective, to keep people honest with themselves about what they're getting themselves into.
Yeah. And also another thing I'd say is there are no clear like winners and losers in the music industry. And what I mean by that is, for example, in sport, if you come first in a race, you've won. Whereas with music, say you're an artist, what's the metric to define whether you've won or not? Is it a number one album? Is it if you've deeply affected the lives of five people? Like, you have to pretty much define your own criteria for success, because you'll spend the majority of your time making music, i.e. working. Mm-hmm. And if 90% of your time is spent doing something where you're not sure what the goal is, you're going to feel shit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I definitely felt that for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. I wasn't quite sure what I was aiming for.
Yeah.
And obviously you have fun doing it. It's great to perform live on stage. It's great. It's such a privilege to be in the studio making music, but having a clear idea of what you want and knowing that you are working towards that and letting other people know what you want as well, and including them in your journey and being very clear with what the objective is, it's so, so useful, and it's a lot more fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Potentially a tricky question.
Mm.
What are you making music for? What's the main driver for you at the moment?
So I want to make music that I love primarily, that feels good to make, is about topics that I really care about, whether that is something that has just happened in my life and I want to document in that song, or it's about something that I see in the world where I'm like, I feel like it should be like this, like Less of a Man, for example.
Yeah.
I want to play to as many people as possible and to share that feeling of connection. That is a really fulfilling feeling for me, knowing that you're connected to a group of people. There's nothing more special than when you see people at your shows who you've seen before and you're like, we are like, it's like a family, it's like a group of friends that, you know, are all experiencing this one moment at a live show. That's a magical feeling. So I want to have that with as many people as possible. And yeah, just to be able to continue to do that for the rest of my life. I love being in the studio as well, making music, coming up with silly ideas, and some of them actually working and resonating with other people on the planet. That's that's such a cool thing to do, you know, with your life. So yeah, just to be able to do that every day is what I'm after, really.
Absolutely. And to appear on the odd podcast.
That's what I love. Yeah.
That's why we do it.
That's why we do it, baby.
No, that's amazing, mate. It's such a good insight. And I think that, you know, I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this, but for me, live music, like, God bless live music for coming back, because it is one of the most, it's gigs are some of the happiest points in my life, just because it's so present, and it's so immersive, and also to get to see people like yourself doing it, just like living that moment and like absolutely loving it, is so, and you do, like, you connect with the people in the space whether you speak to them or not. Like, it is such a powerful experience.
Yeah, so it reminds me why I make music every single time, and inspires me for weeks afterwards in the studio, where I'm like, oh, this will be amazing live. Oh, this will be amazing live.
Yeah.
Speaking of live, I probably will have a tour in April.
April.
Mid-April. That's what I'm looking at the moment. We've got some tour dates. We've got some potential venues which are booked. So yeah, I don't know when this is coming out.
Before April.
Okay. But if you want to see me live, I'll be touring around Europe around April time. So yeah, keep an eye out.
We'd highly, highly encourage it. I will definitely be there.
Nice.
So I'd love to close with just a couple of questions that just popped into my head, like quick fire, just like random questions that I've just thought of. So favorite song right now?
Less of a Man by Zach Abel.
Yeah, banger.
Yeah, great tune.
That spoils the next question, which is going to be, what is your favorite Zach Abel song?
So. Less of a Man by Zach Abel. Check it out.
Yeah, check it out now.
Right now.
Any like favorite artists at the moment, favorite tracks?
Yeah, I really like Joy Crooks.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's amazing voice, and like one of the best lyricists like of our generation.
Mm-hmm.
By far. Celeste is also an amazing artist. I went to see her at quite an intimate kind of like church gig with my mum, and we had such a good time. It was so like inspiring just to see her do her thing. I love Jungle.
Mm-hmm.
They're amazing. Literally live, they sound like the record. Ooh, who's the other one? Remy Wolf.
Oh, that's the only one I haven't heard
okay.
of.
Okay, so. She's sick. Like, she's making, like, funky R&B soul things, which are also poppy, but in a way which you haven't really heard before. And just the way she writes her songs is so creative. And then also her voice is fearless. Mm. Like, some of the things she does vocally, it's like, why have you done that? But it works. And then yeah, Remy Wolf is pretty awesome.
Definitely check out Remy Wolf.
Sinead Harnett also amazing artist, vocals for days, and is just a very lovely person as well.
She paid you to say that.
Yeah, no she did actually. Yes. Yeah.
Perfect. There was another one that I had. What was my other question? I can edit out this bit, it's fine. It's gone. I might just leave this in.
Fuck it's it. Left me.
Yeah, it's completely gone. What a new track, obviously, Less of a Man, mm-hmm. which is everybody's favorite song at the moment. But
of course, yeah.
What's your favorite song to perform, and what's the favorite song that you've ever written? They might be the same.
Favorite song to perform. It's probably a song called Deserve to Be Loved. Mm. There's a few actually, but we'll start with that. Deserve to Be Loved, because for some reason with that song, I don't know what it is about the song. It's a slow song, and it's all about how, you know, regardless of where you come from or, you know, how you feel about yourself, you do deserve to be loved. And something about the sentiment of the song, whenever I perform that at a show, everything just kind of slows down and I feel so centered and connected to the lyrics and the audience. And pretty much every time I perform it, I cry on stage, like every single time. I don't know why. And it's always at exactly the same moment in the song, just after the bridge. That's a really, really powerful thing. And then also a song called Only When We're Naked, which was the title track to my first album. It's all about being completely, you know, emotionally naked and vulnerable, letting loose. And so before I perform it, I always say, like, just imagine you're completely naked in your bedroom listening to your favorite song, which obviously happens to be Only When We're Naked by Zach Abel.
Yeah.
And you're just letting loose and you do like the stupidest dance move you could possibly think of throughout the song. And I try and do that as well on stage, just be kind of like Conor McGregor, arms flailing, like loosey-goosey kind of thing. And I love it. Like, it's everyone just feels that feeling.
Mm.
And it's a real kind of like celebration of like expression.
Yeah. Awesome. I love it. So I think I'm looking at the clock on the wall. didn't even realize it was the actual timer for the recording, but we have got a couple of minutes left.
Oh, cool.
So thank you so much, mate, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
For sharing what you do, for sharing the track Less of a Man. I think it's important and so aligned with what needs to be done and what needs to be talked about. So I think it's really, really special, and kudos to you for writing it and putting it out there, because it's a vulnerable thing to do in itself. So
thanks,
yeah. And you know, you've already plugged the tour without me even having to ask you to, but what's coming up next in terms of new music, singles, albums, tours, what's going on?
So I'm probably going to have a Christmas single out.
Okay.
It's not a Christmas song.
Oh man.
But it is a song which is relevant to Christmas, or in fact any joyous event. And I'm not going to say what it is yet.
Okay.
That'll be a surprise. I know, you know, lots of people will be waiting at home, unable to do their jobs until Christmas arrives, yeah. So they can hear.
I'm going to have to stay
this.
Here.
You're going to stay right there. Yeah. Until the song comes out. And yeah, I really, really love it. It's featuring a guy called Sheku Kanemason, mm-hmm. Who's an incredible musician and I'd say a good friend of mine now.
Nice. Awesome, mate. That's very exciting. Countdown to Christmas is on.
Countdown to Christmas.
We're all waiting for it.
Yeah, yeah.
But Zach, thanks so much for joining me, mate. Really appreciate it.
Appreciate it.
If you made it this far, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you are a fan of the podcast or enjoyed this episode, it would mean a huge amount to me if you could like, follow, subscribe, rate, and review the podcast wherever it is you get your podcasts. Stay tuned for the next incredible episode of Man Down, and I hope to see you soon.